All right, well, let's go back into open session at 8:48. Brian, can you let them know?
Yeah.
Thank you. You ready to go? Okay, so the first item that we have is C1, retirement and payments approval policy. This is a brand new policy that staff is proposing to the board. And what it does is it would, the board would delegate to the executive director the ability to approve the consent agenda. And that would allow staff to be more efficient and process our work more on a rolling basis rather than accumulate work and process it after the board approves the retirement and those types of things on the consent agenda. We are not aware of any time the board hasn't approved an item on the consent agenda. And really, those items, they're ministerial in nature. We follow the plan. You know, we give the benefits we're supposed to do, the refunds, those types of things. So this would really only apply to retirements, joining drop, estate payments, survivor benefits, refunds, those things that are typically on the consent agenda. If there's anything unusual, I would still bring that forward to the board. It doesn't apply to hardships. That rule wouldn't change. It wouldn't apply to the minutes. The board would still approve the minutes. So we are recommending that the board approve that just to help with administration. I know ERS allows the executive director there to approve all of the benefit-related items. Are there questions, comments, concerns? I would also provide, I should have said this, a report, and I'm not sure the format of that report yet, each month, information to you to let you know how many retirements and those types of things there are so you can see if there's trends. I'm planning on putting more than just the 1 month in there, so still, you know, to give you some preparative information, which I think might actually be more useful than what you're getting now, seeing a list month after month. So you can see that every month, not needing to take action on it, but it'd be there for you. Any questions or concerns about this item?
I'll make a motion to approve that staff has the ability to approve the consent agenda.
Thank you.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
I forgot to do that on the last item. Anybody opposed to the other motions we've had? Okay, anybody opposed on this motion? All right, thank you. I'm assuming nobody was opposed on the minutes and the consent agenda before. I'm new at this job. Okay, the next item is the monthly contribution report. This is the October report, which has August data. There were 3 pay periods in August. There's nothing unusual about this report. There's still 105 employees less than the hiring plan. We received $18.3 million in contributions for the month, and the hiring plan and the floor were at $17.4 million. So the floor isn't providing any additional information or any additional money. Any questions on the contribution report? Okay. Thank you. The trustee education and travel. This item has several NCPRS classes listed. One class that isn't listed on here is in April of next year. It's TechSpurs. That's here in Dallas. TechSpurs has a beginning trustee training class, and they may be doing an advanced one as well. So a couple of you need your 7 hours of your beginning time. You can get those 7 hours there very efficiently if you go to that. Also, if you need the continuing education, you can interested in that, let me know. We'll add you to the agenda, and Carol can help you with registration. It's down at the Reunion Tower. Is where it is.
Do you have an actual date? Or?
Yes, it's the 6th.
No, the 7th through the 10th.
Right. The 6th is the business meeting and
yeah.
the ball tournament, and then the 7th through the 10th is actually the meeting.
Usually the trustee training is on that Sunday.
That Sunday?
April. Kelly, I have a question on page 25 that was sent out. It says that the mm-hmm. board needs to approve any education related to regulating the pension. That even if we're doing it on our own dime, our own time, still need to be made aware of it.
So,
am I reading that correctly?
If you're using our money, we need to approve it. If I were you and you were going to something pension related, even if it was on your own dime, I would let us know so we can record it just in case something happens to you to be covered.
Oh, I got you. Okay.
But, you know, definitely if you're spending our money. And we've got budgets, you know, so if you want to attend anything, we'll just add you here and approve it and then.
I should follow the rules. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Carol makes it very easy for you.
I typically go to the trustee to text words, but I just don't know.
We do have a budget for trustees, so feel free. Okay, let's see, moving right along. I feel like I should tell some stories or something. But okay, so the next item. Pardon me? I know. I'll come up with something. No, I can't replace those. So the next item we have is that we're calling a potential technology project. And, John, if you want to come up to the table, you can kind of assist with this item. What this is we've identified three potential technology projects that we would like to put into the budget. But we didn't want to include it in the budget and have all the budget numbers distorted so you couldn't really see what was going on with the routine items. So we thought we would talk about the three projects with you, and then if you are in favor of any of them or all of them, when we do the second reading of the budget and when we send it to the city, we'll add those in. But this way it doesn't distort the totals and you can kind of see what's going on. Two of the technology projects we'll talk about here in open session. The third one will go into closed session under 551-076, which is security-related matters, and we'll talk about that in closed session later in the meeting. So the first project we have is on page 27, and refresh of this room. This building was built in 2008, is that right, John?
Yeah, and we moved in 2009.
Right, and so you want to talk a little bit about what you're anticipating for this room and why we need it?
Yeah, so next year will be 15 years in this equipment, which is kind of old for technology. Everything in our stack here is analog. Everything out there now is digital, which if something fails, means we might have to do this project really fast. And so getting ahead of that, so that we get more modern equipment in, and we don't have a single point of failure that would bring everything down.
So that's this project. Any questions on this?
So has there been any, that $100,000 is talking to vendors on, has there been any?
I'm in conversation with a vendor on this. I talk to more. I'm kind of getting away from the people that built this out. They've just been not very responsive. So,
yeah.
Is the quote pretty firm or pretty high in the sky at this point?
No, I haven't gotten a quote back from him.
You think that's a realistic number? Or?
Yeah, I think that's probably pretty close to what it's going to run.
Okay.
We probably can reuse these monitors. Some of the other ones are not faring as well. These are good monitors, and they're presenting. They're not as high as res, but we don't really need it for what we're doing. And plenty of resolution. So we're going to go to the right solutions, not just replace things, just that need to be replaced. But everything else in there is getting pretty old. We've had to patch some stuff here recently. Time to move on, I think.
Yeah, we have some scrambling around. This was broken for a little while, which is a problem, not that critical of a problem, but there we end up typically have our investment team meetings. Well, we always have our investment team meetings on Wednesdays, but before the board meeting, we typically have it up in this boardroom just to make sure everything's working. And there's been several afternoons we call John. Nothing's working in the room, and he scrambles around and somehow gets it going.
How often is this room used outside of it? Are you using it?
We were using it for weekly for our staff meetings, but now we kind of sit down in what we call there's a big room downstairs by our kitchen area. But for years we've been having our staff meeting in here. And other than that, it's the board meeting and the investment team meeting once a week. Not very often.
IAC?
Oh, the IAC, yeah. Once a quarter.
How long will this room be out of commission then?
Oh, they can probably do it in a week.
Okay.
So there's that project. And then the next project is our pension administration software, which is what runs all the pension benefits. It's the most important thing we do, obviously. We use LRS's pension goals. We're on version 2. They are now rolling out version 4. Version 2 was released in 1998. We've been on it since 2003. It's highly customized at this point because our benefits are very different from everybody else's. We have a great relationship with LRS, and we trust them and trust the software. But it really is not very efficient. Doesn't have all the kind of checks and things to catch errors that like the newer versions do. We have to have LRS script in a lot of transactions when there's something unique about them. We have to call them, and they have to do that piece for us. We can't do that. And it's just not as efficient as the new software. John was just at a conference. What else do you want to add that the new software? And I'm not saying, I should say this, I'm not saying we would go with LRS, but we need, I'm sure all the new versions, new software has the same bells and whistles.
Yeah, yeah. So the current one we're on is it's a database on the back end, and then Delphi is running the front end. Both are version 3 and version 4. The front end that users interface with is web-based, so it's on a browser, which has been the modern way to do things since almost the time we went to version 2. They just didn't have version 3 available at that time. The security, both active and passive, is upgraded. They've just done a really good job of making everything more intuitive for the users. Faster, cleaner, easier to get to. It would actually be the staff and the members on the member portal to be using the same basic interface, so we would have a better feel for how they're what they're seeing. things like file integration, we can just put a file out there for the members on the member portal and it's just there immediately. Right now, that's kind of a cumbersome task to do. And then it's also based on the .NET, Microsoft's .NET framework on the back end, which is what they're planning on using back end going forward. There's, I think, 2020 or 2030 updates they're already planning. They're not planning on changing that. All right, they're not planning on going away from that anytime soon. So that gets us on a very modern basis and gets them to their latest and greatest. Already too behind.
What we're proposing for 2024 is that we look at working with a consultant to help us do some things like assess our current software, define our requirements, identify options that are viable for our plan, write an RFP, review if we get that far. And then if the board approves going to the next step, then issue the RFP, review the, help us review the responses, and then help with contracting. So what we would anticipate in 2024 is we do the consultant part and figure out what is out there. I mean, even though we feel very comfortable with LRS, we feel like it's a big dollar amount and obviously very critical. We need to see what else is out there. The ultimate project, we think, will take about 5 years and probably cost around $5 million, so it's a large amount of money. The Austin Fire is in the process of implementing version 4 LRS, Pension Gold, and they have already started and they anticipate being done at the end of 2025, so it does take a long time. Their benefits are very simple compared to ours, and I think their price is $2.5 million just for the implementation cost. There is right now, did you confirm this when you were meeting with them? What we've been told is there's an, if we said, you know, LRS, let's enter into a contract today, they can't even start for 18 months,
mm-hmm.
and then there's a long. That's why we thought we needed to. My goal is to get new software in place before John retires. So what we're looking for here is either 100 to 250, we're not quite sure how much yet, money for a consultant to do the exploration piece.
And this is typically the process? You hire a consultant to do the RFP, and that's how it's worked before?
I haven't done it that way before, but it seems like, John, that's what you have heard.
When we went from their version 1 to version 2, we hired a consultant to review all of our options.
Yes.
And they came back and did a presentation of that to the board.
Okay.
They said LRS was the best choice for us, and we didn't even do an RFP at that point. LRS is pitch.
Okay, so, all right.
So we could do it that way. We could do an RFP. It's really what we feel, what y'all feel comfortable with.
So you mentioned security. What we have is obviously cumbersome for everybody, but going forward, a new LRS number 4 or whatever we choose would be more secure.
Yeah, so there's additional, more modern.
Okay.
Security involved in it.
So I'm sorry. So we're going to talk, we're spending $100,000 for the system. You said an RFP, to do an RFP,
$100,000
to
$150,000?
$100,000
to hire a consultant.
I'm sorry? To hire a consultant.
Who might
have to
do it all?
You have
to
hire a consultant?
We don't have to do anything that Ford doesn't want us to.
No, we don't have to.
I'm just asking.
Yeah.
Like, if you know what to do, you can't do it? Versus spending the money to hire somebody to do it?
I guess we could do it in-house.
I mean, to be honest with you, staff very happy with LRS and Pension Gold, and I feel like that I trust them, which to me is the most important thing. We had an issue a while back, and they were able to run the payroll for us, you know, at a moment's notice, and that's all that matters.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a lot of confidence in them, but we feel like a project that's, you know, millions of dollars, we need to look at everything out there and make sure we're getting the best bang for the buck for the mm-hmm. members and the board. But we would be fine, you know, after staff just did an analysis. But if we want to do a full in-depth and know you've turned over every rock, then probably a consultant is best.
And there are consultants to do.
Yes.
How long would it take to train the staff on the system?
To train the staff?
Yeah, on the system.
Probably less time than it takes now, because the system right now is not intuitive.
Yes.
So you look at it and... Okay, what does that mean to you? Is this member active? Are they retired? Well, you have to go to this screen and that screen. And
there's a 2 to 3 month parallel process. Well, they're still doing everything on the old system, also repeating that in the new system.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they've had the training up before that, but that gives us a lot of hands-on training doing exactly what we use in the old system. So, you know, it's process everything in the old system, copy it in the new system. Same thing for the second month. If you feel comfortable, then we invert it and process it in the new system. And
and clearly, version 4 is more intuitive and
yes.
than the staff has experience in version 2, that it would seem to be would be an easier transition.
John, would a consultant also potentially save us some money when we're dealing with LRS or whoever, like in terms of what we need, you know, what they think we need and sort of that type of thing? Not necessarily a negotiation, but just simply like, I don't know. I'm just asking.
Yeah, maybe we could have them help us with negotiations on price. they can help. I mean, we have to scope out what we want them to do.
Right.
They usually have a canned list of kind of questions that they go through, and we talk with them, and then they come up with what our needs are. It wouldn't be a complete need process. If we did an RFP, we'd have to go through that.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, LRS might sell us a, you know, a Mercedes, and we only need a Toyota type of thing, you know, to, you know, make it, you know, get what we need and what we want, but not necessarily, you know, paying that.
And we're buying a Toyota, but we're retrofitting it to run the Mercedes.
Do you think you'll include cybersecurity?
Yes.
Okay.
And we would probably move this to them hosting it instead of us hosting it locally, which means their whole security team, their database administrators, they handle all the security, all the updates.
One thought, just for the record, before we hire a consultant, it may not hurt to reach out to, you know, the city, public funds,
right,
and get access to their RFPs when they went through the process.
So ERF has offered to share theirs with me. They haven't sent it yet, but they went through the process not that long ago, and they seem very happy with their selection. It's not pension goals, but they seem very happy with theirs.
Save $100,000.
Yeah. So are you running a duplicate system while you're implementing the new one, or are you kind of?
We would. There's just a huge implementation phase, but. So for most of the time, we would be running our current system, but there will be a period of time where we're running both.
And we'll have multiple data synced up. Once they get to a point where we can start testing, they'll do a sync up, and we'll start testing, and then we'll go through that process. When we get to the parallel, we'll sync them up at the beginning of that, and probably again a couple months later, and then we go live with the new system.
And we can explore this before we set, but, you know, spend any money, come back to the board and say this is where we are, because we just want to really have the ability to start looking around.
Makes sense.
Okay.
My question is, it's kind of a conflict between, okay, do we want to do what, you know, look out for the latest, greatest. I mean, you know, what a responsibility is to the members. So you have the latest and greatest system, maybe spend $100,000 to $250,000 to find that, or if you save $100,000 to $250,000 and say version 4 is probably maybe the most efficient way to do it, and evidently is a pretty solid system.
Mm-hmm.
Not do the RFP and not hire someone to, you know, not hire a consultant. That's the conflict that we're on.
And I just say, LRS, if we're going straight with them, they would come on site and do a discovery with us for free and analyze what our needs are. Once we've selected them, they assess the thing they offer. If we do an RFP, we've already done that process.
I mean, are there huge complaints about LRS?
I've never heard any. But so, you know, what I'm most concerned about is I want to make sure whatever system we use is obviously reliable and accurate, but I also want to make sure that it can change, that it's dynamic and we can easily change it, because the benefits that we have today are not the benefits we had 6 years ago. And when we had to go in and make these bifurcated benefits, we honestly didn't know if we could do it. And they were able to, you know, you get 3% for this time and it's 36 months and then this is 60 months and 2.5%, and I mean, it's very complicated. So I want to make sure that the new software can do what I haven't even imagined yet that we might need it to do.
So is, in your professional opinion, administrator, the best thing to do is probably to pay a consultant and see what's out there?
I think we can start without the consultant and then see what we can learn on our own, and then if we feel like we need additional help to assess our requirements, we could bring them in for that phase.
Because the consultant can help, you know, from the discovery phase of it, because it's about process. It's not just technology.
Right.
It's the contractual part of it that goes into it. That's really the devil in the details. So performance guarantees, termination guarantees, things like that, how they upgrade the system. And two, when you said analog, that by itself, and two, we got to put it somewhere else from a cybersecurity perspective.
Yeah.
Let's put it in the cloud. Let's get it out of here because that's not the business that we're in. You know, we're worried about the pension and our members, not cybersecurity. And that scares me to death. You see that all the time.
It, just that we had the ransomware 100%. There are people who don't like police and fire. Everybody loves fire. People who don't like police all around the world, someone does something and, you know, Oshkosh, Wisconsin, wearing a police uniform, people hate Dallas police force, and someone will get mad. And speaking to, if we can put it somewhere else where it's better secure, we should.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, one thing I would agree with you, Kelly, just in terms of it's a big spend,
mm-hmm.
and it's a long process for implementation, and I just to make sure that we have Canvas and seen what else is out there, and maybe are ahead of whatever is coming by another company. I think it'd be short-sighted just to necessarily go with it.
And I want to know what it takes to implement it, because I know ERF, they hired a whole group to implement their software. Their staff didn't do it. But do we need to do that? And now they have a DBA that's an ongoing person on their staff. Do we need that? I don't want to have a DBA. I know how important they are. So it's those types of technical things that I don't understand. John does, but this might be helpful.
Implementation will be a nightmare.
Oh,
the best day you have is when you sign the contract.
Yeah.
From there, it's downhill.
Yeah.
It's all about who sucks last.
So should we make a motion to have the staff move forward looking at what's out there before we make a motion to set aside this money for a consultant?
We can do that. So John and I will work together, and then we can come back to you at a later date and say we think we need to go the next step with a consultant or not.
Okay.
I'm okay with that.
So make a motion for you and John to set that move forward and look to see what programs are available and out there.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think we'll reflect that as a direction of the board to do that,
the
formal motion, yeah.
Okay, and then the last technology project we'll talk about later in the meeting once we're in closed session. So with that, I will turn this over to Brenda, and she can talk about the 2024 budget.
Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Kelly said, today I'm going to be presenting the 2024 budget. I want to start with information about the budget process for those of you who may be new to the system, that you'll understand how the process works. The system does have a budget adoption policy. A copy of the policy can be found in Diligent under the Resource Center. The system's budget year is January through December, and the annual proposed budget is presented to the board for the first time every October. At the October meeting, the board may propose changes to the budget. Additionally, the board will authorize the budget to be posted to the website and to be sent to the city administrators. Now, the City of Dallas may review the budget and they may request changes, but this board is the one who makes the final determination concerning any expenses for the system. At the November meeting, members will have an opportunity to comment on the budget. Again, board can propose changes or staff could propose changes. And during the November meeting, either the board will approve the proposed budget or direct staff to make additional changes, and then we'll bring the budget back at the December meeting for the final approval. At any time during the year, staff can propose changes to the budget, but the board has to approve any of those changes that are proposed. And each August, so just a couple of months ago, You will receive a detailed mid-year analysis of the budget to actual for the year that will be presented to the board, or is presented to the board every year. So that's just a quick overview of the budget process. Next, I'm going to discuss some of the budget assumptions that were used for this year's budget. Most of our renewing arrangements, things like utilities, janitorial, security, we assume that there will be increase in cost, and we have budgeted 3 to 5% increase for those items for the coming year. Staff and board travel, training, conferences, we've kept those expenses consistent with prior year's budgeted expenses. We did not budget any public relations expenses for 2024. That is an item that we have budgeted off and on as we move closer to the 2025 legislative session, maybe something that we want to do or may want to reconsider for 2024. Risk insurance was budgeted at the same coverage level this year as was renewed, so that is at $15 million in fiduciary insurance, and we've budgeted increases in the 5 to 10% range for each of the lines that we have, and that came out with a blended increase of 5.8% for all of our lines of risk insurance. IT projects that were discussed previously, again, I'll reiterate, they are not in this budget, and if we want to add them into the budget, we'll need to do that. We'll need direction from the board that we want to do that. As we look at staffing and benefits, we have a current staff level of 22, and our plan for 2024 is to remain at that 22 staff level. In the 2023 budget, we forecasted that we would have 23 employees. We have reduced that by one to 22 now. The board did approve a system compensation policy that was approved by the board in January of 2022. We utilize a company called CBiz. They're a compensation consulting expert, and they submit an annual salary letter to us. This letter this year includes the following items, like the structure or range, update recommendation. The recommendation was 3.6%, and then their salary increase recommendation was 5%. For budget purposes, we did use their 5% recommendation for the salary increase. Health insurance was quoted with a 10-15% market increase. We've used 15% a 15% increase for the 2024 budget. Most of the other benefit costs, you know, dental, vision, life, we have budgeted those with 5% increases for the coming year. As we start looking at the budget, here on page 32 is the summary budget. In the summary budget, we track three broad categories of expenses: administrative, investment, and promotion. As we look at the big picture, I want to first kind of just lay out the orientation of the schedule. On the left-hand side, you have expenses. Then your first column is that 2023 budget, so our current year budget, then a 2023 projected annual column, then a 2024 budget, and then the remaining columns are variances both in dollars and percentages. And you'll see this format used throughout the various schedules that are here. So looking at the big picture, the total budget for 2024 is almost $16.8 million. That compares to $18.2 million for the 2023 budget, or down $1.44 million, or 7.9%. And that decline is primarily driven by declines in management fees. When you compare the 2023 projected actual of 16, almost 16.4 million were up 435,000 or 2.7%. And that increase is primarily driven by increases in actuarial services and staff expenses. Then I also want to mention the 2023 projected actual at the 16.35 million is under the 2023 budget of 18.2 by 1.88 million. And this decline in expenses is driven by lower than expected investment management fees, other investment expenses, and risk insurance fees. So let's move to the next page, page 33. This is the detailed budget. So it's line by line. Again, the same layout with the various budgets and proposed actuals and variances there. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the schedule, but just to let you know, this is the detail where you can go and look at every line item and the variances that are there. As we go to the next page, page 34, I just want to point out kind of in the middle of the page, which is at the bottom of the schedule here on 34, you'll see the supplemental budget. And we allocate 0.87% of all of our expenses to the supplemental budget, and you can see that here. So let's go to page 35. And on this slide, what we're going to look at is a comparison of the 2024 proposed budget to the 2023 budget. And what I've highlighted here are any accounts or any items where the budget change is $25,000 or more and the percentage change is 5% or greater. So these are your biggest variances. And I'm just going to highlight a few of them here. That first one on line one is actuarial services. So we're projecting that it will increase about $238,000. Your first question may be why? Why would they go up that much? This increase reflects the actuarial work that's going to be associated with that statutorily required independent actuary analysis that we're going to have and do the work in 2024 ahead of the 2025 legislative session. So that's hiring that independent actuary on top of the actuary that we already have, the extra work that both of those are going to have to do for that. So we're expecting a pretty hefty increase in 2024 as we go through this legislative, prepare for this legislative process. As we move down the page and we look at reductions that we are expecting, line four there, investment management fees, we're expecting them to decline almost $1.1 million or 11.6%. And the decline in the budgeted fees are due to negotiated public equity fee deductions. That's one thing that the investment team has been working on. A higher allocation to passive equity and some projected sales of the legacy real asset investments. That's going to drive that decline. As we look at item five, the liability insurance, down $330,000 when compared to last year's budget. And this reduction from that prior year budget reflects the board decision after the 2023 budget was adopted to reduce the liability insurance coverage level. So that's where we went from the 50 down to the 15, about $300,000 difference there. Item seven, information technology project, down about $105,000. John has made significant progress during 2023, working on all of our cybersecurity projects. We have additional projects that we'll be working on in 2024. Those, again, focus primarily on cyber remediation, and they're driven by our insurance requirements. Just to obtain cyber insurance has become much more difficult and a lot more requirements there. So we're continuing to work on that. And again, I just want to say that the projects that we've talked about or that we will talk about not included in this technology project budget here. As we go to the next page, page 36, this comparison, again, same layout as prior, but it compares the 2024 budget to the 2023 projected actual. Just a couple of items to highlight here. If we look at row two, the investment consulting and reporting, it's up about $82,000. Although we budgeted private market services in 2023, we did not utilize any of those services, and we have rebudgeted an amount for the private markets for 2024. So that's creating that variance. And then as we look at item number three, the other portfolio operating expenses, up $81,000. These are fees that are related to some private equity investments. They were less than we expected in 2023, but we're projecting them to increase in 2024. And as we move down and we look at reductions, we see employment expenses. We're expecting them to decline about $52,000. We are fully staffed at this point, so we expect to have fewer open employee positions in the coming year that would require us to engage an agency and have agency fees in 2024. Are there any questions about the detailed variance lines or about the 2024 proposed budget? That's a pretty quick run through.
I've got a question. If we move forward with the technology upgrade and they're 18 months out, would that cost be on the 2024 budget? How does that work?
No, what we would do is we would put in only what we think we're going to incur in 2024. So if we say yes to the boardroom, then we would put $100,000 into the boardroom. If we say yes, go forward with the consultant, then we would pick that number where there's 100 or 250, and we would add those items in. But that big $5 million, that's a ways out, and we'll budget those in the years that we think this will actually occur. Any other questions?
Just one quick one. Has there been an analysis, I'm sure it has been, going back to 2017, and tracking these various expense items to the present?
We actually had this very conversation. I generally present a chart that shows the expenses kind of in these broad categories, investments, professional and administrative. But in the last few years, we've just kind of been bumping along in the same places, so I opted not to do that this time. But I'll bring that back in November. I mean, what you'll see is there were significant decline from 15, 16, 17, and then it's kind of leveled off. Although, you know, sometimes it's a little bit up or down, but I'd be happy to send that to you or bring it back for November.
Yeah, thinking of the future, that might be something handy to have.
Okay, sure. Again, we had a discussion about it and said, it didn't seem like there was a lot of changes, so I'll be sure to do that. Okay. Any other questions? Well, I think we're going to need a motion.
Oh, that's right. The motion is on.
Let me go back.
Yes, you can go back to the.
Oh, I went the wrong way. Sorry. I'm going the wrong way. Let me get you back.
I can read it as you find it. So the motion that we're looking for is direct the staff to revise the proposed budget based on the direction of the board and bring the revised proposed budget to the board at the November 2023 board meeting for consideration for adoption, and authorize forwarding the 2024 proposed budget to the City of Dallas for comment and the posting of the proposed budget to the www.dpfp.org for member review prior to the November meeting, which is all right there at the bottom of the sheet.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you all. Audit update, please. Okay. Unfortunately, we have not yet received the audited financials from Huff Energy. This is now the latest. Last year we received them on September 14th. So this is now even longer than the prior long time. We did have a call with Bill Huff on Monday, and his best estimate is at least another 30 or 45 days, which puts us to mid to late November, and I think we didn't come away feeling really confident that he would be able to hit those marks. Ryan had another follow-up conversation with him yesterday. I mean, these financials are material to DPSC, and that's why we have been waiting on them. However, we have a call scheduled with BDO, our accountants, our auditors, to determine what our options are for moving forward. With a clean opinion, can we do additional work? Can a phone call with Bill Huff, you know, how can we get them comfortable? How can we move forward? What are our options? We just don't feel like we can wait on him anymore. So that's what we'll continue to work on. Again, in the meantime, we're doing what we can to work ahead and get the parts of the financials complete that we can. But we're going to meet and see how we can move forward without him. We did impress on Bill that this isn't just an inconvenience. You know, this year, in addition to being, you know, inconvenience and he's not following the contract, it has real-world implications because of the process that we need to go through with the funding. So he heard that loud and clear, which is why he had the second call with Ryan. But he says it's out of his control.
Yeah, I noticed that was one of the items that you included at the last minute in terms of the private stuff and so forth. We have an opportunity to talk about what kind of recourse we might have as we get to that point.
Sure. Any other questions about the audit? Okay. So this next item is really an update on the funding. So in our statute, which is Article 6243A-1, Section 2.025 is that section that lays out that whole process for needing to have the independent audit, the independent actuary, and the timeline and the process. So that's why that title is what this is. But this item is really intended to provide you an update of where we are. We've had a lot of questions about what are we doing, where are we going, what happens next. So we wanted just to give you an update. And the first three items are very short, and I'm going to give you a little update here in open session. And then, like the technology project, when we go into closed session for legal, we'll talk about item D here on the list. So to start with, I wanted to let you know that the city has formed an ad hoc committee on pensions, and the chair of that is Mayor Pro Tem Tanel Atkins. There's eight council members on that committee. They had their first meeting on September 19th of the committee. Bill Quinn and Rob Walters, who were on the mayor's task force, and many of you know, obviously you know Bill, but Rob Walters used to also be on our board here. They provided an update to the committee. I think it went really well. They covered the causes of the insolvency. They highlighted the changes in HB 3158. They talked about the mandated evaluation process, discussed board's accomplishments, kind of the migration of the portfolio, talked about the funding status and what would a lump sum of $1 billion do to the funding, those types of things. Overall, I think the meeting went very well. There were a lot of really good questions from the committee members. They seemed very positive and seemed their questions seemed solution-oriented, so I think that went very well. The next item is actually a meeting that's happening today at 1 o'clock. From 1 to 3, there's another meeting of the committee. And on the agenda for this meeting is Cheryl from the executive director from ERF, the civilian plan. We'll be doing an overview of ERF, and then Josh and I will be talking about DPFP. So they asked for very high level, again, some background information, which we've provided a couple of times. They wanted to know about the plan changes that we've done so far to help the funding situation, benefit structure, and we're going to talk about, again, the liability of the plan and some issues related to litigation, plan litigation in the past. And that's really the subject for today. So we are happy to go to those meetings whenever we have the opportunity and continue to work with the city on that. At the next meeting, kind of going into C here, Chiron will be here at our next board meeting on November 9th, and they will present to you their findings from the first phase of their work. So I know they have gone through already and replicated Siegel's 1-1-22 actuarial evaluation and didn't have any problems with that. That was fine, and they're working through the process of their recommendations at this point. I don't know what they are. I haven't seen them. I haven't talked to them. But they will be here. It will be the first item on the agenda on November 9th, maybe after we elect officers. And then once they leave here, at some point during the day, I believe the committee over at the city is going to try to schedule a meeting that day so Chiron can do an update for the city as well. So that's what's going on, that we're progressing as we had hoped to at this point. Are there any questions about either the meetings or where we are, where we're going? Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, one question. In your meeting this afternoon, or you know, with Cheryl and the city, do you get a sense that they're going to try and raise additional capital for their unfunded 5.4?
So although ERF doesn't have the same requirement in a statute because they're an ordinance plan, they do fall under the PRB FSRP rule. So they need to, on the same timeline we are under, need to get to 30 years to fund. And to do that, they need, same thing, they need more money in or a change to their benefits, something like that. So they're, I believe they're 50 years to fund currently. Their funding ratio looks better than ours, but they still are not in compliance with the years to fund. I believe their solution that they're going forward with at this time is just to try to change the contributions to take the cap off the city contribution.
Okay.
But I don't know. We'll be interested to see what they say today.
Okay.
All right. The next item is investments. So, Ryan.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We'll start with the portfolio update. On liquidation of the private market assets, we have the detailed quarterly review later in the agenda, but distributions have slowed down quite a bit the last 2 months. We're at $52 million year-to-date. Most of that's coming from the AEW project in Phoenix that we sold and the J.P. Morgan Maritime Fund, which is a shipping vessel fund. We'll talk about these next two items, and we'll talk about them again, and then we'll talk about them in detail. But Global Growth Equity Search, the two finalists presented to the IEC 2 weeks ago. At that meeting, we're going to talk about our recommend manager, WCM, in a moment here. On the safety reserve, just a refresh, we notified the board in March of 22 that we were putting the safety reserve into a drawdown, which meant we were drawing on the cash and short-term bonds to cover benefit outflows while the market was dislocated. We've been having discussions last few months, and we did a presentation at the IAC on how to operationally exit the drawdown mode and refill the safety reserve up to the target of 9% or 18 months of benefit outflows. Overall returns estimated through 9/30, up 4.3% for the entire DPFP portfolio and up 7.1% for the public market, which make up 70% of the portfolio. Looking at initiatives going forward, the two items we'll talk about today with the growth search and some IPS updates that are required, looking into early next year, we plan to do a custodian search in the first part of the year. Our current custodian is J.P. Morgan. We've been with them forever. Asset allocation study planned for early 24, so we'll start right at the beginning of the year there. I think Makita's long-term updated assumptions will come out in February. And then private market planning, once we get Allborn up and running, we're looking at IPS provisions, pacing studies, et cetera. That probably is, just given where we're at on the current private markets portfolio, that probably slips a little bit later into 24. And looking at the equity market drawdown from the beginning of 2022, so even though the markets are up this year, less up than they were 2 months ago, we're still in a pretty decent-sized drawdown from 2021 highs, early 2022. You can see EM is down the most, down 25%. S&P, U.S. stock market's holding up the best. These numbers, if you looked at them today, are about 3 to 4% higher than they were when we ran this a week ago, which goes into kind of the rebalancing amounts we'll look at. On the yield curve, Treasury rates are at all-time, or not all-time, 15-year highs. This is the top line looking at current as of a week ago compared to the green line as at the beginning of the year. So the longer end of the curve has gone up quite a bit the last few months. On the public market portfolio snapshot, I'm not going to cover these managers in detail, but a few things to point out here. Up 7.1%, as I mentioned earlier, year to date. Longer term, up 3.6% over the 3 year period compared to a 60-40 benchmark of 1.3. Global equities underperforming a little bit year to date, but outperforming on the 3 and 5 year periods. And then looking at fixed income on the 3 year, it's down 1% compared to the benchmark of down 6.6%. A lot of that is due to shorter duration and U.S. focused of our fixed income portfolio. Any questions there? So we ended the month at $1.87 billion in NAV, which is up 4.3% from the beginning of the year, $85 million in net benefit outflows, and $125 million in gain and other income in the portfolio. So on the safe reserve, right now we're at $93 million in cash and short-term bonds, $66 million. In IRNM, the short-term bond portfolio, 27 in cash. That compares to a target of 168. Currently, the level of safe reserve would cover outflows for the next 9 months or through June of 2024. If you look at the bottom right here on the cash level, we have the $10 million a month roughly in net outflows. So as we get into November, towards the end of November, the cash level will be quite low. So that's why we're looking at actions we can take to refill it back up to target. On the asset allocation chart here, we'll talk about it momentarily, but the thing to point out is because we are overweight to private equity and real estate, most of the public asset classes are at target or under target. So in order to liquidate proceeds to refill the safe reserve, we have to draw away from target the target allocation to each of those asset classes that we'd be looking to raise proceeds from. So that's the fix to the update to the IPS we'll talk about next. Tom, and I know I talked about a lot of what we talked about at the IAC, but we had the meeting 2 weeks ago. Anything you wanted to add about the meeting?
So. Yeah, the... We covered several areas. One, the candidates for replacement, and the conclusion. Well, the discussion was with WCM and TBO at the end of the day. Fortunately, but let me take a step back. The first of all, I want to compliment the staff and the consultant for all the work that was done and making that decision for much easier and more palatable. The IEC did discuss the two candidates that, that presented, and both are very competitive firms. WCM is more concentrated. They and also has better alignment of interest. The process, investment process by both, well-disciplined and good integrity of process. They met all the standards in terms of relative performance. At the end of the day, after a lot of discussion, the preference was WCM. For full disclosure, one of the IEC members voted for T. Rowe, and that was part of the, you know, the presentation for the IEC. The other areas covered were the fund for as far as meeting cash needs and so forth, and possible policy changes to that effect, and they were all in concurrence with staff's recommendation to that end, and that I think that pretty well covers the IEC.
Okay. Yeah, Makita,
I would like to comment.
Sorry, Christina.
Okay, so I was there too. That was my first meeting. So I'm not sure how it was conducted, but I, you know, like kudos to staff. They did a great job, and just kind of having these two guys present. They both were very independent. I think I'm kind of considered the vote for T. Rowe Price. I'm not so sure, but I think I was, because I will tell you why. I thought that they were, the bench was a little deeper and they were a little bit more conservative in the way they presented. But with WCM, I think the main guy was a little salesy for me, if you will. But when the portfolio manager spoke, he was a lot, he kind of quelled any anxiety I had over cynicism I have for a very big salesmanship. But WMC, what they did do is they did, whereas T. Rowe Price was talking very much about favored nations and not really making concessions with us, WCM had the ability to do that and put their money where their mouth was. And they did say, we really want this account and we will make concessions. So, you know, I think the only thing that comes up to speed is like how that those concessions look like. But for the most part, I think the both of them did seem very capable and their numbers proved that. So I just kind of wanted to, and I think when I think back about the T. Rowe Price, even though they were very structured and deep benched, I kind of, maybe that comes along with some bureaucratic levels, which makes it less efficient. So either or, it's really just what the preference was. I think both choices were exceptional. So I think we are better off with, we're okay with either. That's kind of where you may have seen a vote that was tilted towards T. Rowe Price a little. And that's it. But I'm absolutely fine with staff. I support staff on WCM. Right.
I was remiss as well, and not, there was one other item that was covered at the IEC meeting. That was the investment policy statement in terms of closing the IEC meetings to the public, which we can talk about as well.
Yeah, we're about to. So the next item will go into a little more detail on the growth equity recommendation and what that looks like. And then we'll talk about the safe reserve and the IPS update after that. Yeah. So just to get a bit more background on the search, I'll turn it over to Akshay.
Good morning, everyone. I'll start off with the search process. So we started off the search process with the help of eVestment. We looked at the global growth universe. There were 355 products in this universe. And then staff kind of laid out various criteria and analyzed and got that number down to 14 names. Staff then held the calls with each of the 14 firms, and we also held calls with Makita's research team, and ultimately got that down to six RFP candidates, whose name you can see on the screen. So after reviewing the RFP, the four managers, you can see Sea Worldwide, Intermeet, T. Rowe Price, WCM, were interviewed for 1 hour each between August 28th and September 8th. After the interviews, T. Rowe Price and WCM were selected as a finalist candidate, and as you already heard, WCM was the recommended manager. Here's some high-level information on both the finalist organization. You can see WCM firm-wide AUM is roughly $80 billion, and roughly $18 billion of that is in this product. Their employee ownership, 75% of it's 75% employee-owned, and 25% is owned by Natexis. The investment team consists of four portfolio managers and 11 business analysts. Their process is a bottom-up fundamental approach. They run concentrated and high-conviction portfolio. They also seek to identify companies with durable economic moats that provide a sustainable competitive advantage over their peers. And WCM is also in Makeda's bullpen. Here's a comparison of the characteristics between both the finalists versus DPFC's global manager lineup. As you can see, WCM runs a more concentrated portfolio with 36 holdings that roughly ranges between 30 to 40%. Of portfolio in top 10 is 36%. Their annual turnover is 42%, so they invest with a long-time horizon approach. Their active share is a little higher than T. Rowe's. It's at 88%. And their tracking error, it's 5.8, which is slightly lower than T. Rowe's. With that, any questions on this? I'll pass it on to Ryan.
So, yeah, as a reminder, the search was initiated to replace Invesco, who was our prior global growth equity manager. The funding right now, we used Russell to run a quasi-index to the equity growth until we got through a replacement. The timing of the search worked out really well because just with the time of the IAC meetings, we had more time before issuing the RFP to canvas the universe and talk to some firms on the front end. I'm very happy with the two that presented to the IAC. Recommendations, WCM, I guess in addition to what Tom and Tina said, I think the PM team is very strong, and they've been through one succession already. They have a clear second generation of investment talent at the PM level. It's effectively running this portfolio right now. It's a concentrated portfolio. We had some issues with concentration concerns on Invesco, but they were more related to risk controls in the top 10, and they had a very large position in one stock up to 12. Everything in the WCM portfolio is about 3 to 5%. I think they have a unique way of looking at the world in terms of they have a very strong focus on corporate culture, and they have a whole different team of culture analysts that look at the companies they invest in's culture. So with that, there's a lot of background materials we provided here, memos from Makeda, materials we presented to the IAC, but recommendations to hire WCM, and we'll work on, I expect contracting to be fairly quick, and then we have the proceeds currently in Russell that will transition into that account once it's up and running. Any questions?
If you agree with the recommendation, we would look for a motion to authorize the executive director to enter into an investment management contract with WCM.
I'm just curious. Why didn't WCM do performance-based fees? They don't do.
They do. So I don't want to talk about the fees in detail.
Okay.
But we are proceeding with the performance option, performance option with WCM.
Okay.
I like the structure of it quite a bit. I would say we spent a lot more time discussing internally, you know, do these performance fees make sense? What are we trying to achieve with them? So we spent a lot of time considering,
okay,
you know, these two options, and we'll work towards getting the performance fee one done. And if we can't, then we have a very good flat fee option as well.
Motion and a second for, I don't think we've got this in writing, but it's to authorize executive director to enter into an investment management contract with WCM. All in favor of that motion?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you.
All right. Now I want to click to get through all this stuff. Okay. So the next item is talking about revision to the IPS in a few different spots, initiated primarily by the Safety Reserve Plan. Makita gave a presentation at the IAC about the history of the Safety Reserve, why it's there, the size of it, how it's worked in the past, and how we've used it twice to go into a drawdown during COVID and then over the last year and a half. What we haven't had to deal with is how to, once you draw it down from target, operationally how to fill it back up to target and when is the right time to do that. So what we are recommending or notifying you guys of, we think given that the market has recovered somewhat from 2022 lows, it's been a little bit rocky the last 2 months, we don't have a lot of clarity on upcoming private market proceeds. Cash levels are getting low. We have plenty of liquid assets to refill it from, but we need to replenish cash over the next 2 months to rebalance from the public equity and public income portions of the portfolio, bring the safety reserve back up to target, which would extend the period out to March of 2025 that we have benefit payments covered within that 9% allocation. I guess the other difference now is the yields on the cash and short-term bond portfolios are, you know, considerably higher than they were 2 or 3 years ago. Cash is yielding 5.3%, IRM is yielding 5.8%. So blended, we're getting 87% of the assumed return within that safe reserve portfolio. So I'll go through, this is the presentation Makita gave on the history. The two things we need to update in the IPS is in order to, we need to update the rebalancing language so we can actually pull public equity and public fixed income away from the target. Right now they're a little bit below, so we have to pull them further below. So language is saying that right now it says rebalancing must move something towards the target, or what we're adding is, or removing the safety reserve closer to the target. So in order to refill it, you know, to do the rebalancing, we can do it as long as the proceeds are going into the safety reserve. And then right now in the IPS, there's notification required to let the board know that we plan to enter into a drawdown mode, which we gave in March of 2022. We're adding, we will notify the board if we make the determination to refill or restore the safe reserve back up to target, which is what we're doing today once that's approved. Any questions on those two changes to the IPS or anything on the safe reserve plan? Okay. So two other changes that we're recommending to the investment policy statement. So Tom mentioned on the ISE meeting, originally they weren't open to the public. We added provision 3 years ago to make them open to the public, but currently we can go into closed session at any time for any reason. The only people that ever call in our reporters. I don't think we've ever had a member call into the meeting. From an efficiency standpoint, we're talking about managers, you know, frankly and in detail, interviewing them and talking about fees, so it makes more sense to do that in a closed forum if we can. And then as we are entering a period where we're looking at new private market investments and private equity, I think it'll be especially important to be able to hold those in a closed forum. So, Josh, anything you want to add there?
No, I think this is incredibly confusing. I know, and we go through this every time about whether this is, it is a meeting that is open to the public, but it is not an open meeting under the open meetings laws. So, and there's no requirement that it be held pursuant to the Open Meetings Act because there's no quorum of the board. There's no reason to do it. But the prior determination was there was a desire to make it open. But I think over the years it appears to staff that the benefits of keeping it closed far outweigh this idea of keeping it open to the public, especially since it doesn't appear that the public even listens. So I think that's why there's this desire to close it. But this is not in any way skirting or in violation of the law. This was the board's choice to keep it open, and now, you know, it's staff's recommendation to just close it.
Thanks, Josh. The other cleanup item in here, this goes back to the Global Alpha, which is the international small cap manager that we hired a couple years ago, a year and a half ago. We had this provision under the public commingled fund investment managers that required them to be a fiduciary to the fund. What we learned as we were going into the Global Alpha product is they were just claiming their fiduciary duty to some extent. We talked to the IAC about it. We talked to outside legal. It was market for this type of fund in terms of what they were, you know, stripping away from the fiduciary duty. So instead of having that provision in there, we are the language has required fiduciary standards that are not unreasonable in light of market terms for a similar investment, which is what we determined on Global Alpha. So we just want to make sure we don't run into that issue again going forward. All right, if there's no questions, there'll be a recommendation to approve these changes to the IPS.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Nay. I'm opposed to all of making all of those changes. Yeah, I'm sorry. I want to closing off the investment meeting. Could you tell me why the board? I just really like transparency. I know no one's showing up to the meetings, but to remove their right to show up to the meetings, I guess, bothers me a little bit. Sorry. I stopped you right then and there, but I was kind of mulling over it. So is it because it's a cost? It costs more. It's more difficult to do an open meeting versus a closed meeting.
It's just we want to be able to discuss managers in detail that we don't want to be open to media picking up. Have very in depth conversations about sometimes confidential matters. Right now we can close it for any reason, and we've closed it quite a bit. So we just kick whoever's here off the phone if we need to talk about something confidential. So instead of just closing it ad hoc, when we get to an item, it just seemed to make more sense to have those meetings not be open to the public anymore.
At the last meeting after the presentation for WCM and HERO, the committee started having a conversation, and they were being respectful, but they were saying their opinion, such as, the person, I think I'd work better with the personality of this person versus, there were things that just didn't need to be in a newspaper.
Sure.
And then we were talking about fees in particular. Go back and negotiate this fee. Well, what if you can't get to that fee? What would you go to the other one? And at, we actually forgot to go into closed session, so I walked over to John and said, you know, we need to go into closed session on this. So it's those kinds of frank conversations. We could keep it open and continue to try to remember to go in closed session. But.
Also, for the record, public funds that use investment advisory committees, those are not open to the public. They're, you know, the IEC will participate at the board meeting where it can be on record. In a lot of cases, the IEC will make a recommendation, and the board will take that recommendation, but that's at the actual board meeting itself. It's not separate. In most cases where you have a separate IEC meeting, there is a lot of, there can be confidential information that's shared, which is not for the public dissemination. The other is that there may be opinions expressed because these are investment people that may be detrimental if put in the press. So it's cleaner to have that part separate.
The other thing is that we Tom's right, and that was, we were very much an anomaly when we put this into place several years ago, and you know it was fine as an experiment. But for instance, even the states like TRS, where Tom was the CIO, and TRS, they have their own provisions that even when they're doing certain investments, they can actually go into closed session at the board level, and we don't have that. We do not have that ability when we're talking about a private investment, for instance. So, you know, there's a lot of how the sausage is made kind of stuff that you try to keep, you know.
We're just moving this to the industry standard, basically.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
I mean, the other thing, though, the IEC is not making any decisions on their own. They make recommendations back to the board, like on WCM, for approval.
Which is then open for?
Yes.
Okay. All the members have a way to get the information firsthand.
Mm. Okay. Okay. Did you want to talk about any of the other ones?
That was the only one.
Okay. Gotcha.
Else yep.
All right. Thank you.
So do we record you as a yes?
You record me as a yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Okay, so the next item is the quarterly private asset cash flow projection update. I'll make this quick because we have not had a lot of activity, but I do want to talk a little bit about why we're doing this and for the new board members, what we're showing here on a quarterly basis. So we do this report on the first and the last month. No, sorry, it's October. First month of the quarter, recapping activity in the private market portfolio during that quarter, and then we do a projection going forward of what we expect to sell over the next, right now it's a year and a quarter. We've been doing this report for 5 years now. I would say as we get longer into it and less private market assets remaining and less control over the ones that do remain, it's becoming a little bit less useful, but I still think it could be a briefing item to the board. And as we engage with Allborn, they start doing cash flow planning and pacing analysis, I think that would replace what we're showing here. Because that's considering, you know, what's coming back and then what the commitments into the private market program would be. This is looking at private asset activity since 9/30/16 is when we formally started liquidating assets in the portfolio through secondary sales and other means. So we've had $1.4 billion in distributions in the portfolio, $245 million in capital calls, and the market value has gone up $135. We've gone from $1.6 billion, which is over two-thirds of the portfolio at one point, and the private market portfolio down to $541. It's the same information, but just since the new board formation. This is looking at the month that I don't have this report. This chart here will be in the portfolio update. But since 2018, the private asset inflows have covered 104% of benefit payments. Obviously, that, as we talked about, will flip once we get the rest of the legacy private market assets sold and start making new investments into private markets. This is looking at quarterly activity in Q3, a couple capital calls on the timber and infrastructure portfolios, and then we got some sales proceeds out of the Clarion assets just out of downtown, and then a little bit closing out the Camel Square investment. So the quarter we just had was the lowest quarter we've had since we started tracking. And we've talked about this ebbing and flowing, and it seems to be going in a pattern last couple of years. But what we have left in the private market portfolio is very concentrated in three investments. Of what we plan to sell, we have some assets that we're keeping in the portfolio, but AEW, Huff, Lone Star make up more than 90% of what we plan to sell. So, and those are large assets. So when the money comes back, it's not going to be as regular, and we will have some spike quarters and quarters like this where we have very little activity. Then looking at the projection through end of 24. The projected amounts in 24 are very high and higher than we've ever had, and that's just a kind of like what I just said. Assets are going to come back at some point. We don't know exactly when. Some of these might extend past 24, but in the model we're showing Huff coming back in 2024, which is driving quite a bit of that activity. This is looking at the current portfolio of private market assets, how much of it is defined as legacy, and I should say the legacy assets were the ones that we classified as either troubled, more difficult, messy, or unsure of return expectations on them. So previously we had used a step up to this and greater return with the legacy portion of the portfolio earning zero. Right now they are 70% of the private market portfolio and 20% of the overall DPFP portfolio. And this is looking at, there's our target long-term of 15% to private market, 5% to private equity, 5% to natural resources, and 5% to real estate, where we're at currently and where we've been. So as I mentioned, we were at points in 16 and 17, over two-thirds of the portfolio was in private markets, and we're down to just below 30 now and working towards that 15% target. Any questions on this report? Thank you.
Okay. So the next time, is this whole item in closed session, Lone Star?
Yes.
Okay. So before we do this item, I'll do the executive director's report, which is really nothing. The ANSIPRS monitor in the materials for you. The link for the text version is there. And we didn't have any open records requests this month, so that was good news. Before we go into closed session, we've already had the public comment section, but we have Council Member Mendelson and a member, and I didn't know if either one of you wanted to speak. You're welcome to if you'd like. No obligation.
Just here to learn and make sure that you know that we're very interested. I think Kelly did a great job of planning what's happening with the pension committee. We're meeting at once, and we've got a strength together.
Thank you. Okay, we'll go into close session for 551-071, which is legal, and 551-076, which is